Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel of New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneur Zalman Neufeld. In Salvage Poetics, Post-Holocaust American Jewish Folk Ethnographies, published by Wayne State University Press in 2020, Sheila Jelen explores how American Jewish post-Holocaust writers, scholars, and editors adapted pre-Holocaust works, such as Yiddish fiction and documentary photography, for popular consumption by American Jews in the post-Holocaust decades. These texts, Jelen argues, serve to help clarify the role of East European Jewish identity in the construction of a post-Holocaust American one. In her analysis of a variety of hybrid texts, those that exist on the border between ethnography and art, Jelen traces the gradual shift from the verbal to visual Jewish literacy among Jewish Americans after the Holocaust. Sheila E. Jelen is Associate Professor of Hebrew and Jewish Studies in the Department of Modern and Classical Languages, Literatures, and Cultures at the University of Kentucky, Lexington. I'm so glad her new book has brought her to our program. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So to get started, could you please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this book?
Thank you. So my background is that I started my career in Hebrew literature. I got a PhD in Hebrew literature, really in comparative literature with an emphasis on Hebrew and English and Yiddish at the University of California, Berkeley. And my first book project was on a woman writer named Devorah Baron, who was born in what is now Ukraine. And she was the daughter of a rabbi. And she moved to Israel in 1911, I believe. I've already forgotten, even though I wrote a book about her. And she wrote stories about women's experience in Eastern Europe, Jewish women's experience in Eastern Europe at the turn of the 20th century. And when I was writing about her, I was really interested in hearing her stories, particularly about women's experiences, because my own grandmothers had been born in Eastern Europe, had survived the Holocaust. And I felt to some extent that I was hearing through Devorah Baron the stories that my grandmothers weren't comfortable telling me. Little details about life, such as, you know, when they made pies, they would put them on the windowsills to cool, or what it was like to be infertile in the shtetl. And so I was asking a lot of questions about Devorah Baron, what she wrote about, how it reflected real life in the shtetl. And my advisors were very, very, very hesitant to encourage me to look at her work from an ethnographic perspective as a description of a culture. So I wrote my book without really acknowledging that I was very, very interested in her work, in part because of the culture she was telling us about. I really was supposed to be focusing on her modernist techniques and on her role as a woman writer in a cadre of male writers in a moment in Hebrew literature when women didn't know Hebrew. But there was one story in particular called Fradel, which is the name of the protagonist of the story. Fradel goes to the ritual bath. She goes to the mikveh. And the story really goes out of its way to explain what the mikveh was. And a lot goes on in terms of the drama of the story and the institution where it takes place. And I realized in analyzing that story that my next book was going to be about where literature does ethnographic work, how literature, specifically from the turn of the 20th century in Jewish languages such as Hebrew and Yiddish, acknowledges the decline of a world that was already in decline before the Holocaust. World War I was very hard on the Jews of Europe. And there was also a lot of modernization, the rise of Zionism, the rise of socialism, a lot of secularism happening at that time. So Devorah Baron was one of many writers who were actually documenting a world in decline. And one of the interesting paradoxes is that she was writing in a sacred language. She was writing in the language of liturgy, the language of Jewish texts, which was Hebrew. And just by writing a modern literature in that language, she was acknowledging that she was already modern and she was pretty secular. So that was one of the origins of this book. I decided that I really wanted to understand how literary texts do ethnographic work for us. And so that was one starting point. And then I had another starting point for this book, which really goes back to childhood, when I would visit my father. I grew up in Chicago. My parents were not married anymore by the time I was a teenager. And I would spend Shabbat with my father at his house every other week. And his new wife had a whole collection of picture books, of photo books, in the back room where I used to sleep. And I spent many, many, many Shabbat afternoons looking through these photo books of life in Eastern Europe. And I was really fascinated by them. And I was a person who, I went to Orthodox Jewish day schools all my life through 12th grade. And I was perfectly well-versed in Jewish culture as it was lived in Chicago. But I still felt as if these photographs were giving me a window into a world that I really knew very little about. And so I decided when I became a professor that I really wanted to think a lot about the role of those photo books in American Jewish understandings of East European Jewish life, because I myself, you would think, wouldn't need to look at those photo books, but I did need to, and I enjoyed them, and I got so much out of them. So Salvage Poetics, the book that we're talking about today, really came out of me at the crossroads of those two phenomena, right? The question of what role do photographs play in post-Holocaust American understandings of pre-Holocaust East European Jewish life? And what role does literature play in understandings of pre-Holocaust Jewish life in Jewish languages?
Oh, thank you for that. So for kind of setting that up here. So your book, you focus a lot on the, you call the third generation of Eastern European Jewish immigrants in America who after World War II end up going, moving into the suburbs or leaving the cities, they're moving to the suburbs. And along with their change in their class status and their geographical location, there's also all sorts of changes in their Jewish, you know, the kind of the nature or quality of their Jewishness. And you frame it in terms of Nathan Glazer, the famous sociologist, when he talks about Jewishness versus Judaism. What did he mean? What do you get from that that distinction?
Great question. I start my book with a discussion of Nathan Glazer's book called, I think it was called Judaism. It was written in a series that represented the major religions in America. It was written alongside a book on Protestantism and Catholicism, if I remember correctly. And what Nathan Glazer writes about is the sense that by writing this book, he was participating in this misunderstanding of Judaism, right? That Judaism wasn't a religion in the way that Catholicism was a religion or Protestantism was a religion. But by being asked to write this book and by agreeing to write this book, he was participating in the reshaping of Judaism for an American understanding of Judaism. So what was that? Nathan Glazer describes the way that Jewishness is both a culture and a theology. And so the Jews who are Jewish, who practice Jewishness, do so much more than attend synagogue. They, if you look at it on a religious spectrum, Judaism is very much a home-based religion. It involves everything from how you eat to how you put on your shoes to what you say when you wake up in the morning to the blessings that you make before you do almost anything. And so as Jews became more middle class and started moving out to the suburbs, they began to try to create a Judaism that wasn't so organic to the everyday life of the Jews. They tried to create a Judaism that was more like a community center, more like a church. And even if you weren't looking at Jewishness within a religious context, but you were looking at it from a more cultural context, you have writers like Irving Howe, who describe the Lower East Side world that they grew up in, where you didn't have to necessarily be Jewishly observant to feel extremely Jewish. It had to do with the Yiddish that was spoken. It had to do with the food that was eaten. It had to do with the literature that people were familiar with from the old country, etc. So even if you weren't incorporating Jewish law into every minute of your life, there was a sense that you lived in a Jewish neighborhood. There was a sense that the people you interacted with all came from a common Jewish world and worldview. And so what Nathan Glazer was doing by distinguishing between Jewishness and Judaism was he was saying, in trying to become upper middle class white Americans, what we've had to do is we've had to turn Judaism into the kind of religion that upper middle class white Americans practice, which is, you know, a religion that is very much practiced in institutions, but isn't necessarily pervasive of every aspect of life. And so what I trace in Salvage Poetics really is how American Jews who are interested in the third generation, especially after the Holocaust, in the world that was destroyed, had to find means of understanding that culture without a great degree of literacy. So, you know, the third generation didn't really know Yiddish anymore. They didn't really have a good grasp of Jewish texts, by and large. Their Jewish experience was really limited. And so what I'm looking at are these texts that were adapted from the old country, essentially, both visual texts like photographs and literary texts like the stories of Shalom Aleichem, for example. They were basically translated, narrated, adapted, glossed, explained for an audience that really wanted to get a glimpse into that world, but really didn't have the skills to do so if they were handed a prayer book, or if they were handed a Talmud, or if they were handed a Yiddish story. So people like Maurice Samuels, for example, took the stories of Shalom Aleichem and he translated them, and he also glossed them. He turned it into a kind of explanation of East European Jewish culture on the basis of the Shalom Aleichem stories that Americans were very familiar with through Fiddler on the Roof. And that is what I call a hybrid text. It's a text that exists on the border, as you said in your introduction, between ethnography or the description of a culture and literature. But something that I noticed while I was navigating this shift from between Jewishness and Judaism, I noticed that as you move further and further away from the Holocaust, the texts become more and more visual. And that, I think, is also a question of literacy, because it's much easier to look at photographs than it is to read a short story, even if it's translated from the Yiddish, because so much of the short story itself, for example, presumes a kind of Jewish literacy. So if anyone has ever read the stories of Shalom Aleichem, which I teach in my classrooms, it's actually very hard to understand them, even if they're in English, because the humor that grows out of them is really a humor that's based on familiarity with the liturgy. So, for example, Tevye, in one of the early stories of the milkman cycle that Fiddler on the Roof is based on, tries to say the Amidah, the 18 benedictions, which is a basic prayer in Judaism. It's recited three times a day on regular days and four times a day on other days. It's a very basic prayer, but it requires that you stand at attention with your feet together. And Tevye in this story is running after his horse while he's saying the Amidah. So obviously this is hysterically funny for anyone who's ever spent a lot of time saying this prayer in a synagogue, because one of the first things you learn as a young child is how to keep your feet together during this prayer, to stop wiggling and to stop laughing and to stop talking, right? But in the Tevye story, he's like running after a horse while he says it. Now, this works really well for people who understand that prayer, but for a college classroom like the one I teach in, they don't know what the Amidah is. They don't know that this is funny. So basically, that's what I'm documenting, is how these texts become more visual in order to accommodate the lack of literacy in a community that has lost its Jewishness, but has become more Judaic.
Right, and that process you refer to as salvage poetics, right?
Yes, so salvage poetics describes the way that an artifact from pre-Holocaust East European Jewish experience is basically adapted for an audience in America. One thing I want to add is that the texts that are usually used for this purpose already have a seed of adaptation within them. Like I described before, Devorah Baron, where I started this project from in my first book, she was already creating texts that were documenting a world being extinguished. So her texts are particularly interesting as a literary text that can be used in a hybrid way, because it already acknowledges its own demise. So salvage poetics really are those poetics that emerge from a text or from a group of photographs, which I'm sure we'll talk about in the course of this conversation as well, that are already embedded with a kind of nostalgia or a kind of explanatory tone that becomes useful for a scholar or a writer to jump off of in further adaptations and in further explanations for an audience that really needs that assistance.
Right. And you mentioned Maurice Samuel and what he was doing with the Shalom Aleichem stories in his books. And I think it's worth just highlighting that for a moment, that obviously all translations on some level are also interpretations, right? There's no such thing as a quote unquote pure translation. And yet, clearly, what Samuel was doing with the Shalom Aleichem stories was taking it to a whole nother level. And if you could speak about that and how we could see very clearly the distinction between what he was doing and especially his role in the final, or his place in the final product, compared to a kind of regular translation from one language, you know, to another.
Absolutely. One of the interesting things about the Shalom Aleichem stories is that, you know, the name of the author was actually not Shalom Aleichem. It was Shalom Rabinovich. And he created a literary persona, which he called Shalom Aleichem, which means how do you do in Yiddish, based on the Hebrew for Shalom Aleichem, which means peace unto you. So in the original stories, there's this character named Shalom Aleichem who talks to Tevye. And Tevye tells his story to this guy named Shalom Aleichem, who says, okay, now that you've told me your stories, I'm going to write them down. So the interesting thing about what Maurice Samuels does in his adaptation of the Shalom Aleichem stories for purposes of creating a hybrid text that will help Americans understand a lost world is he injects himself, Maurice Samuels injects himself into the story, and he takes on the role of Shalom Aleichem. It's as if he's describing a world that he himself is inhabiting, and he is giving us a tour of that world. So it's not that he's talking to Tevye in the way that Shalom Aleichem, the character, talks to Tevye in the stories themselves. He's actually talking to us. And he is making it possible for us to understand what Tevye is talking about. And so this is actually something that I document in a lot of the texts that I study and write about in this book. A lot of these authors really had a stake in this work that they were doing. And they felt that in order to really build a bridge between American Jews and East European Jews across the abyss of the Holocaust, they needed to be a part of both stories at once. They needed to be a member of the American Jewish community that they were speaking to, and they also needed to have some kind of credibility when it came to the Eastern European Jewish world. So the truth is that Maurice Samuels was born in Eastern Europe. He was raised in England, and he came over to America when he was already in his, I think in his 20s, as part of his army service. He came over to America as a part of that. And so he talks in other works that he's written about the fact that when he was growing up in England, his family used to have like Yiddish story nights, and they would lay around and read Peretz and read Shalom Aleichem. And he feels like, even though he was very, very young when he left Eastern Europe and moved to England, he still feels like it was a part of his upbringing, and he goes out of his way to share that. But what's most interesting to me is how he does it in the world of Shalom Aleichem. He becomes Shalom Aleichem because he feels that he has to have a foot in both worlds. And he also wants to adopt some of the strategies that made Shalom Aleichem so popular. I mean, what the reason people loved Shalom Aleichem so much was because he was really speaking from the people to the people in the idiom of the people. And Maurice Samuels feels the need to reproduce that in his work. We see that as well in Roman Vishniak's very famous photographs that are published in A Vanished World. He basically tells the story of each photograph as if he is the subject of that photograph, as if he knew the subject of that photograph intimately, even though it's not even clear that Roman Vishniak knew enough Yiddish to talk to the subjects of his photographs. He knew Russian. He grew up in Russia. But he basically makes up stories about each of the photographs in the later version of his publication of those photographs, which came out in 1983. In the earlier version of those same photographs, which came out in 1947, I believe, there are very minimal captions. And the stories basically, the photographs tell their own story. But in the later version, as we move further and further away from the Holocaust, and as we move further and further away from Jewish literacy, he really feels the need to incorporate himself into the story of each and every one of those photographs. I call this a kind of autoethnographic approach. And I see it, you know, again, I see it in common between Maurice Samuels and Roman Vishniak. But another example, I think, of this is in Lucy Davidovich's book.
Wait, sorry, 1 second. I want to ask you one detail about, yes. I can listen to you forever. I want to ask you one detail about the Roman Vishniak saga that you talk in your book, one of the many moments in your book that I really love. You talk about how he inserts himself into a Helm-like story. And if you could tell us about that, because I think it's just brilliant.
Yeah. So, this is a whole big story. I'll begin with this and I'll probably branch off into something else. But yeah, so there's one moment, he takes a picture of a cart driver. And he tells this story. He says, I had to be driven out to some remote place to do a photo shoot. And I asked this cart driver to drive me there. And I said, leave me there for 3 days and then come back and get me. So the cart driver took him, left him, and came back 3 days later. And when he came back 3 days later, he asked for 3 days worth of money. And Roman Vishniak said, why are you charging me for 3 full days? I just took 2 rides with you, right? Here and back. And the cart driver said, well, in those 3 days, while I was waiting for you, my child died. My wife got sick. I had to pay for burial. I had to pay for doctors. It was a very traumatic 3 days. And the whole time I was, you know, counting the minutes until I had to go back and get you. I was keeping track of time. I was on the clock, and you were on the clock too. And Roman Vishniak, of course, felt terrible about the terrible things that had happened in his family, and he paid him for the 3 days. So this is as you said, a Helm story, a story about fools, right? About, you know, people who are so foolish that they're brilliant, actually, right? And this is a genre of Jewish literature that became very popular at the turn of the 20th century. Indeed, they were published and collected by a photographer named Menachem Kipnis. He was a photographer, but he was also an ethnomusicologist and an ethnographer. He was killed. He died in the Warsaw Ghetto, but he did collect a bunch of Helm stories, and they were so popular, in fact, that people from the actual city of Helm, including my own great grandfather, were mortified because they couldn't get their daughters off anymore because everyone from Helm was a fool. So why was Roman Vishniak claiming this experience if in fact it's a recognizable Helm story? And so before I answer that question, I want to give a little more background. When I was writing about Roman Vishniak, his photographs are very, very famous. Most people have a copy of his book, A Vanished World, somewhere on their coffee table.
Could you just describe really briefly, what are the pictures like? What was he photographing? What's the kind of the feel of those images?
Yeah, so he was commissioned by the Joint Distribution Committee to take photographs of East European Jews in the mid-1930s in order to help raise money for them to immigrate. So he was supposed to be taking pictures of Jews who are impoverished and traditional, so that American Jews would donate money for their immigration. And the photographs are just that. They're in black and white. They're very, very beautiful. He's a very talented photographer. They are mostly of men, traditional Jewish men carrying holy books around on the street, men in traditional Jewish dress, men in houses of study. There are some women mixed in here and there. Now, the interesting thing is the period in which he was taking these pictures was a period of immense productivity and culture and education and shift and change and modernization among the Jews. But you don't really see any of that in his photographs. His photographs really are like a throwback, you know, to the, you know, early 19th century in terms of where Jews were at. But these were the Jews that, you know, these were the photographs that were going to help the cause, right? So those are the photographs he took. And he was really made famous by these photographs. There was an exhibit recently in New York at the International Center for Photography that was curated by Maya Benton, which attempted to show us the other Vishniak, the photographs that he took that weren't of Orthodox Jewish men. And that was an interesting undertaking and an interesting exhibit.
If I could just interject for one second, I think I must have, maybe there was an article, a write-up or something about the exhibit that you're referring to, and I saw those pictures and I almost plotzed. I lost it because I, like you were describing, I grew up surrounded by volumes of Roman Vishniak's quote unquote, you know, shtetl Jews, these very traditional Eastern European, like you said, mostly men, very pious, whatever. And then I saw these other pictures of circus acts or people at zoos or something, and I couldn't believe, first of all, that the same photographer took both sets of pictures and that the same world existed in Eastern Europe at the same time. He didn't go, you know, from Eastern Europe to Paris or something. Like, this was both like two totally different, almost apparently kind of hermetically sealed worlds taking place at the same time in very close proximity to each other.
Absolutely. And there was a book published in the late 1970s called Image Before My Eyes, which attempted to present a Jewish world that was not all traditional and all pious, but that was actually doing theater and writing poetry and, you know, revolutionizing labor practices and stuff like that. And in fact, I do focus on that book in one of the chapters of my book as well. So to go back to the question of why he felt, you know, why he felt the need to incorporate a Chelm story into his own personal biography and frame the stories and the photographs in that way, when I was first writing the chapter on Vishniak, I had to seek out rights to a lot of his photographs. So I went to Maya Benton, the same person who did that exhibit, and I had to request rights to his photographs from her because she was in charge of that. And she sent a copy of my chapter to Vishniak's grandson. And his grandson is a historian, and he was very concerned that I not reproduce any of Vishniak's fictions, including some, you know, something like the Chelm story as his own biography, right? He was very concerned about that. And it was so interesting to me because I'm not a historian. I'm a literature scholar. And for me, I didn't care if he really did have this interaction with the cart driver. What I cared about was why he was using a Chelm story in order to frame this photograph. And also, what was he doing with all the stories that he told, incorporating himself into the photographs? What was he trying to accomplish? You know, I cleaned up my chapter to make sure I kept the facts separate from the fiction to satisfy the needs so I could get the rights to the photographs. But again, I want to reiterate that what's interesting to me is the story that's crafted, the story that's told from artifacts in order to build a bridge between the old world and the new world, between the world before the Holocaust and the world after the Holocaust. And so I think that's why he was using this Chaim story, because he was using the Chaim story as an artifact, and he was pairing it up with the photographs in order to build a bridge.
Right, right. And so one thing that I wonder is, how self-aware were those who were involved in the process of salvage poetics? How self-aware were they about their own involvement in the process? In other words, did they know and did they acknowledge that they were creating a mediated artifact rather than, quote unquote, a simple translation or a simple representation of what was out there, you know, before the Holocaust?
Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, in my literary training, I was taught never to ask what the author intended.
Oh, wow. That's always my first question.
Yeah. But I do want to say that I think that they were a lot less hung up on changing things around as necessity demanded, right? So for example, in my introduction, I talk about other ethnographic projects that were taking place at the turn of the 20th century that I looked to as models for what my American historians and writers and cultural critics were doing with these artifacts, these texts, and these photographs. And Buber, Martin Buber, was one of the examples that I presented in my introduction. And Martin Buber took Hasidic stories and he translated them into German, and he edited them and streamlined them and presented them to a largely assimilated German population who was disaffected by the fact that they were really assimilated. They felt that they wanted to understand more about the world that they had left behind. And there was a big debate over the changes that Buber had imposed on the Hasidic narratives, because he's presenting it as a genre that is authentic and religious and deep to an audience that is thirsty for that stuff. But in fact, what he's presenting them with is not the real deal, right? It's really his version of what these stories contain. And he did discuss it in some of his essays. And he says, I really felt that if I didn't change them in certain ways, they wouldn't be readable or comprehensible. And there's some truth to that, right? And so I think that you know, the academics and the scholars were much more concerned about what Maurice Samuels was doing to Shalom Aleichem or what Martin Buber was doing to Hasidic stories. But I think, again, my focus is on sort of popular audiences and the question of how do American Jews know what they think they know about pre-Holocaust East European Jewish life? What are they reading? What are they looking at? How are the people who are producing those materials engaging with those materials and adapting those materials? So the question of consciousness or unconsciousness, yeah, I think they consciously knew that they were making pretty dramatic changes, but they also consciously knew that they had to, that they had to. One, I think, interesting example, I brought her up earlier and I didn't finish my thought, but Lucy Davidovich, who was a historian of the Holocaust, she edited a book. It was an anthology of essays, basically, called The Golden Tradition, in which she tries to represent the major streams of thought in East European Jewish life from before the war. And my observation about her book is that she basically doesn't represent Orthodox life at all. So even though just a few minutes ago I was talking about how Roman Vishniak only represented Orthodox life. Lucy Davidovich didn't really represent Orthodox voices. She had like a couple of essays that did represent that, but much of the book is about secularism and socialism and Jewish art and stuff like that. And I asked myself the question, how could you do that? I mean, it's easier to ignore the secular world when you're trying to memorialize the Holocaust than it is to ignore the Orthodox world, right? So where was she coming from? Well, she spent a year in Vilna at the YIVO Institute before it moved to New York and before the war basically started. She left on the very last boat, I think, that could take her back to America in 1939. And she basically had spent one of those transformative years that one spends as a young adult, sometimes if you're lucky enough to do so, in Vilna, where she was living with families and she was learning with great scholars of Jewish history. She had wanted to get a PhD in English literature at Columbia and was not quite into it enough. And with the help of a teacher in New York, she shifted gears and decided to go to YIVO and see if she wanted to do Jewish history instead. And it turned into her vocation, her life's work. But she basically abandoned all the people who had nourished her and nurtured her during that year to their fate. And, you know, YIVO is known to be a secular institution. And so I think in many ways, her book, The Golden Tradition, was an homage to the secularism of YIVO. Was she conscious of that? I don't think so. I don't think so, because she writes in later years about how she began to attend synagogue every week. And it sounds like she basically became a much more observant Jew. She'd never set foot in a synagogue, I think, until she was a young adult, because she was raised in a secular Yiddishist home. So quite conscious, unconscious, I don't know. But certainly, it certainly had a tremendous impact on what people were reading and what people were thinking about that world.
Right. Well, that's a good answer. You were speaking before, you mentioned before about how for you and for this book, the real focus is on popular culture and how kind of the masses, the Jewish masses, absorbed and responded to, these cultural representations. Now, one of a major example of a hugely successful popular production, of course, is Fiddler on the Roof, which is still beloved and by so many. And you mention in your book how the process of producing the original Fiddler on the Roof Broadway show was itself inspired in part by an image that had a kind of a surprising origin. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So when Jerome Robbins was approached and asked to produce Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway in the 1960s, he was a disaffected American Jew. His bar mitzvah had been a kind of traumatic, uninspired experience, and he wasn't sure he could pull it off. But he decided that in honor of his father, whose world he'd never really tried to understand, he would take this on. And he started looking for a photograph that would be his muse, that would inspire him. And he found this photograph of a boys' cheder, a house of study for little boys, very little boys, probably 5 years old, 4 years old. And it was taken by Cornell Kappa, I believe. And it was taken in New York. It was a Rebbe, a teacher, leaning over a table of little boys and pointing to a text. Now, this photograph, interestingly enough, is in a photograph of Jerome Robbins himself taken by Henri Cartier-Bresson in his office. And you can see that in Jerome Robbins's office, he has his photograph framed and on the wall. So the question is, how does a photograph taken in New York, probably in Crown Heights or Borough Park, right? How does a photograph taken in New York become the muse for this play that came to represent all of Eastern European Jewish experience for not only American Jews, but really for the post-Holocaust world, right?
And the photograph was taken post-Holocaust.
Yes, it was taken in 1950. So, yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I'm trying to trace, really, is how do images become the dominant way for people like Jerome Robbins, right, to produce a play like Fiddler on the Roof. And what is Fiddler on the Roof? Going back to the beginning of our conversation, Fiddler on the Roof is an adaptation of Yiddish short stories that you need to basically be Jewishly literate to understand. So how does that become the way that the world understands East European Jewish culture? If you think about it, Fiddler on the Roof has only one Yiddish word in it. What is it? L'chaim. That's it. And so it's just a very, very, it was a very interesting starting point for Jerome Robbins to come up with this photograph. And what it tells us, quite simply, is that we're more comfortable looking at ourselves. And if we can find a way to not recognize ourselves, but to be looking at ourselves, we will be able to take a step forward towards understanding the other, right? So here's an American photograph taken after the war in America. And it becomes a channel for Americans and the rest of the world, really, to understand something very distant.
Right. And one of the works that you look at is the ethnographic work titled Life is with People, written by Elizabeth Herzog and Mark Zabrowski in 1952. And that became an extremely popular text. I know as a used books, someone who spends a lot of time hunting for used books in Jewish circles, many, many people's parents or grandparents have a copy of the book on their shelf. I don't know if they've read it, but they have it. And how is it that that became such a popular text with the masses when it was so severely criticized by scholars at the time?
Yeah. Yeah, so Life is with People is an interesting story. It was commissioned as part of a project at Columbia to try to understand cultures that were in decline. It was overseen by Margaret Mead, who was a student of Franz Boas, who was a founder or a creator of the notion of salvage ethnographies. So that's really where the title of my book came from. What was a salvage ethnography? It was studying a culture that was basically becoming extinct, and it was his work was on Native American culture. And you know, there's a lot of complicated layers to being an anthropologist going in and trying to document a dying culture. Is that anthropologist a part of the process of killing that culture, right? And this takes us, of course, back to Devorah Baron's very self-conscious use of Hebrew as a sacred tool for secular means. And so she's documenting the decline of a culture in the language of that culture. So Life is with People was commissioned in that sense. And it was using a method that they were experimenting with called culture at a distance, because at that time, most of the Pale of what used to be the Pale of Settlement, where most of the Jews in Eastern Europe had lived before the war, was inaccessible because of the Iron Curtain. And so the authors of this book couldn't really, there was nowhere to go. You know, they couldn't go to a shtetl. The shtetls had been destroyed, and they couldn't even go to where the shtetls were in the way that Jonathan Safran Foer in his book, Everything is Illuminated, which is a very, you know, fictionalized form of this, but, you know, the character in that book goes back to a shtetl, or to what remains of a shtetl. They couldn't even do that. So what were they doing? They were interviewing people in New York City, people who had come from Europe, or people whose parents had come from Europe, or people whose grandparents had come from Europe. These were their informants. And what I noticed in reading this book was that these people often said, basically, well, my bubbe tells me or told me that gefilte fish from Galicia was sweet. You know, and so, but this is, you know, hearsay. How could this be an ethnography, right? Or more importantly, people were saying, well, you know how it was. You've read Mendeleev, you know, or you know how it was. You know what Shalom Aleichem describes.
Referring to literary works that were of fiction.
Exactly. So these native informants were actually reading the same text that you and I could read and saying, well, you know, and so Life is with People, again, like the photograph that Jerome Robbins used, we were looking at ourselves. These were New Yorkers. These were people whose grandparents and great-grandparents were like our grandparents and our great-grandparents. And the only difference between the stories they had to tell and the stories that we had to tell were that there was a bunch of, you know, a bunch of ethnographers standing behind it. Now, it's important to remember that Mark Zborowski and Elizabeth Herzog, neither of them were anthropologists. And in fact, Mark Zborowski turns out to have been a very problematic figure. He was considered, I don't even want to say, because I don't remember the details, but he was basically not considered a savory character.
According to Stephen Zipperstein, Zabrowski was a Stalinist hitman.
Exactly. Thank you. My brain is a little fuzzy at the moment, so I didn't remember all the right terminology, but yes. So he was like an undercover agent.
Undercover assassin.
Exactly.
I mean, they say that the pen could kill, but this guy also had a pistol.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
According to some authorities.
Yeah. But so what made this book so popular, though, was that it was accessible. It was accessible. And it was familiar, and it was comfortable, just like, you know, the joys of Yiddish, which I don't write about in my book, but I just read an article about it recently. The joys of Yiddish by Yiddishists was considered ridiculous, right? But you should see the kinds of love letters that Leo Rastin received when he wrote this book. People were just, you know, it was like they were liberated to finally embrace the Yiddish that they didn't really know, you know, that they simply didn't know. So I think the Life is with People operated the same way. It was comfortable. It was familiar. It was accessible.
Right. Well, that does explain a lot. I'm curious. You talk in your book a lot about both texts, translations of texts, and then also images that are part of this salvage poetics. Are there also, and you mentioned how because of the decline of Jewish literacy, images became so much more important because they were so much more accessible. Along the same lines, are there examples of films that function as part of the salvage poetics?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, I want to say, first of all, that I'm really interested in the cinematic concept of montage. So putting together images that the viewer has to basically make heads or tails out of, that the juxtaposition of images helps people to tell their own story about the work that's in front of them. So a lot of the photographs that I analyze in my book are works that photographs that find their way into films about Eastern Europe. So I just want to say that first of all, that these photographs have a very rich afterlife, which is still going on today, where when people want to tell the story of a shtetl, or people want to tell the story of a visit back to Europe, or anything like that, these photographs are central in a montage sense. They serve as backdrops to scenes and narrations that are unfolding. Now, in terms of films that use some of these techniques, I think you and I, in an earlier conversation, talked about the recent Coen Brothers film. What was it?
Right, A Serious Man from 2009.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about that, because you brought that to my attention. I was so struck, and I think it is a really good example.
Well, I was just, so inspired by your book and all of its insights about the kind of repurposing, repackaging, recycling of, some cultural artifact to a later, in a later period, and trying to make it accessible. And I was reminded that in the opening scene of A Serious Man, which is, the film in general, is in English, but the opening scene, the whole scene is in Yiddish. And it's like a scene between a husband and a wife and a child, maybe a couple of characters, all, supposedly in the shtetl, in a small, Eastern European, a Jewish village, and it's entirely in Yiddish. And I guess there's subtitles. I don't remember, but the point is, it's supposed to evoke a whole world, the vanished world that Roman Vishniak is kind of pointing us towards, and then it's juxtaposed with the rest of the film about suburban Jewish life, exactly the kinds of people that you're talking about in your book, people who are struggling with their bar mitzvah because they can't read Hebrew, and so on. And it just seemed to me like that might be an example of a cinematic salvage poetics.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting example. There was also another film recently, I can't remember the name of it. It was A Man's Name. It was about a Hasidic man whose child is taken away from
Menashe.
Menashe, right. And I think in many ways the Yiddish language, as it appears on the American stage nowadays and also in American films, is what's being salvaged. It's the artifact in a lot of these examples that you're talking about. And in my book, I do discuss the Yiddish Fiddler on the Roof that was on the stage right before COVID, which was just a phenomenon. I mean, everyone was running to see it from all over the country, really. And what was going on there was very interesting, I think. So I feel like Fiddler on the Roof has become a sacred text for American Jews. I think that it's replaced, just like Shalom Aleichem in many ways replaced the prayer book for Jews who are becoming modernized in Europe and moving to America. I think Fiddler on the Roof has become, has replaced Shalom Aleichem and other sacred texts of Jewish experience in American life. And I think that people were getting thirsty for something deeper. And what they wanted was Fiddler on the Roof in Yiddish, in its original language. And I think that that goes to what Jeffrey Chandler talks about in his work about a post-vernacular, where people like my husband, for example, who don't really know Yiddish but think they do, you know. He says crazy things every so often while he's cooking that I think he heard in his parents' kitchen that's totally mispronounced and has all the wrong letters. But, you know, he learned it as a child from second generation and he thinks he knows Yiddish, you know. And so what is a post-vernacular? It kind of takes us back to that discussion of Jewishness versus Judaism, right? A post-vernacular is, you know, you kind of know Yiddish, you know enough to get by. You don't even really need to know Yiddish at all to experience Yiddishness, you know. And Fiddler on the Roof in Yiddish was, on the one hand, perhaps an attempt to move beyond the post-vernacular, to say, well, it's not good enough to have a play that's from Yiddish literature that only has one Yiddish word in it, which is l'chaim. I want to actually hear all Yiddish words in it. Yeah. And why is that so important? Because this is a sacred text. Because this is an institution that every Jewish American knows, and they want to get more out of it. So I think that's a really good example of salvage poetics.
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of... there's just so much to think about in this discussion because, like you were talking about the recent Broadway play of Fiddler on the Roof in Yiddish, and how essentially the fact that it was produced in Yiddish was an attempt to kind of reclaim something more authentic than the original English play or film in English. But one thing that's kind of disturbing about this whole thing is that, in a sense, you know, there's no going home. We can never go back. You know, where are we going back to? You know, because almost all of the actors I saw, like so many others, I flocked to the Broadway to watch the Yiddish play. But as someone who spoke Yiddish when I was a kid, I'm very familiar with Yiddish and Yiddish accents, and I was very disturbed by the Broadway production because almost none of the actors are native Yiddish speakers. They just kind of learned the lines 2 weeks before the show. And again, for people who don't speak Yiddish, maybe they couldn't tell. But for someone who actually speaks Yiddish, their Yiddish was very peculiar, and it definitely didn't have a kind of Hamish, homey feel to it. You know, it seemed something very artificial, to the extent that I found it really quite troubling. So I think it just highlights the complexities of everything that we're talking about here, where there's a constant drive to try to reconnect and re-embrace some aspect of an earlier period in Jewish history and Jewish culture. But we, whoever the consumers of this culture is in the current situation, we are not the people who were living in Eastern Europe in the early 20th century or, you know, pre-Holocaust. So our own linguistic abilities, our own sensibilities, all of that is just so irredeemably different than it was, you know, in the pre-Holocaust era. And therefore, there's going to be endless complications.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, I studied Yiddish starting in college. My grandparents spoke Yiddish, and it was my parents' first language growing up. But I was not raised in Yiddish. And I started studying it in college, and I continued studying it in graduate school. And I learned a Yivo Yiddish. I learned a kind of... cleaned up, standardized Yiddish. And my mother, who is not a Yiddishist and who really fled from Yiddish as a, you know, when she figured out that the whole world didn't speak it in Chicago, she sometimes, my son is studying German and my husband with his fake Yiddish is also studying German and trying to like reconcile the two languages. So sometimes they'll pose questions to me, and if I respond with the Yiddish that I know and my mother is present, she laughs at me because my Yiddish isn't her Yiddish. And it's really nobody's Yiddish, you know, it's the standardized Yiddish, right? So, yeah, I mean, even people who are somewhat literate are irredeemably distant from the world and the language that so many people are trying to claim.
Right. All right. Well, last question. Could you tell us what new project you're working on now?
Right. So first of all, my Salvage Poetics project on American Jewish experience really grew out of a Salvage Poetics project that I was doing on Israel. I was very interested in how Israeli writers write about East European Jewish life. And I started this project really with an essay on some Yiddish women, well, Eastern European Jewish women who emigrated to Israel and wrote about their experiences in Hebrew. And I was very interested in how Israelis were able to assimilate women's stories about East European Jewish life in this language that to a great extent pushed Yiddish down, right? That pushed Yiddish to the margins. So I'm writing a book called Israeli Salvage Poetics, which isn't really a follow-up on this book as much as it's a precursor to this book. I have essays on Amos Oz, I have essays on Shai Agnon, and on these women, Malka Shapira and Ita Kalish, and David Grossman. So that's a book that I'm working on now. I'm pulling together. And I'm also writing a book called Testimonial Montage, which is based on a collection of Holocaust testimonies given by survivors of the Krakow Ghetto Uprising. These people were all part of Zionist youth groups in Europe, in Krakow, and they rose up against the Nazis and then testified in Israel for many years afterwards. And I'm just very, very interested in understanding how in a very communal culture like Israel, they're able to navigate in their testimonies a communal story and an individual story at the same time. So those testimonies are all in Hebrew, and I'm working with them. I'm doing sort of what Maurice Samuels was doing. I'm translating them and glossing them, because I don't think Americans or English reading people know about the relationship between Zionist youth groups and ghetto uprisings during the war, or about how very different a testimony given in America is from a testimony given in Israel. So I'm navigating that in my book, Testimonial Montage.
Wow, that all sounds fascinating. Sheila, thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for reading my book.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.